These are African rhythms, passed down to us through ancient spirits. Feel the spirit, a unifying force. Come on, move with the spirit. Stand up, clap your hands.
From WSNC 90.5 FM Broadcasting Service, an NPR affiliate of Winston-Salem State University, welcome to Africa World Now Project. I'm your host and producer, James Pope. Today, the spiritual paroxysis of the music of John Coltrane through the words of Alice Coltrane. Africa World Now Project is next. To understand the music of John Coltrane, you must understand the long genealogy of a genre of African diasporic cultural expression called Black classical music, or jazz as it is often labeled, particularly as it moves back and forth on the time-space continuum, from the now moment to the future moment as yet seen, to the complexities of the past, back to now, never in a linear path. You must listen to Sun Ra, Diz, Bird, Sonny, Brother Ah, Abdullah Ibrahim, Celia Cruz, Tito, Hugh Masekela, Abby, Lincoln, Ella, Nina, Holiday, De La, Tribe, Guru, Heavy, the birds, the wind, the rain. You must be able to map the material and non-material experiences, often improvised in response to the conditions within which African peoples found themselves. You must understand the deep ancestral, historical, and spiritual memory of a people to simultaneously be aware of these conditions while also seeing a world beyond those conditions. John Coltrane, the person, the musician, is a vital link in a long chain of humanity, a representation of an African vibration of humanity. Amir Baraka, in his article, John Coltrane, Why His Legacy Continues, writes, "Why does his legacy continue to influence our lives, our music, and the arts?" Train emerges as the process of historical clarification itself, of a particular social aesthetic development. When we see him standing next to Bird and Diz, an excited young inlooker inside the torrent of the rising bop statement, right next to the chief creators of that fervent expression of new black life, we are seeing actual point and line, note and phrase of the continuum, as if we can also see Lewis and Bichette hovering over them, with Prez hovering just to the side, waiting his interest, and then beyond in a deeper yet to be revealed hover, Pharaoh and Albert and David and Winton are Olu in the mist they are about to be, when called by the notes of what has struck yet before all mentioned. Train carried the deepness in us through Bird and Diz, and them back to us. He reclaimed bop fire, the Africa, improvisation, blue spirituality of us. The free jazz was parallel to free Huey, free Angela, the ballad of the bullet, free black people.
The poem for John Coltrane called I Love Music. It begins with a quote from Train. Quote, "I want to be a force for real good. In other words, I know that they're bad forces. Forces that bring suffering to others and misery to the world. But I want to be the opposite force. I want to be the force which is truly for good." Unquote.
For Amir Baraka and many others, Train still sounds inside us as the freedom we seek, the total expression of our lives as the expression of the human-headed soul, teaching that the flaming paradise of his music is in us to create the world we live in. But above all this, more than any of this, to understand Train, you must understand his wife, Alice Coltrane. You must listen to her organized vibrational melodies that seek in their own space to free people who did not know they needed to be freed, and as of yet still not know they need to be freed. Today, we will listen to a radio documentary produced by the Pacifica Archives. We hear Alice on Train and an interview with Train less than a year before he moved beyond. Our show is produced today in solidarity with the Native, Indigenous, African, and Afro-descendant communities at Standing Rock, Venezuela, Corporation Jackson in Jackson, Mississippi, Brazil, the Avalon Village of Detroit, Colombia, Kenya, Palestine, South Africa, and Ghana, and other places who are fighting for the protection of our land for the benefit of all peoples. Enjoy the program.
Music is so wonderful. It's so powerful. Music is utilized for healing. Music makes people forget their pain, their troubles. Music is used in practically every religious service all over the world. It's a powerful, nearly invisible force that reaches into the hearts of people. Not only the intellect and the intelligence, but to reach into the heart and the spirit. And that's where good is taking place.
The music of John Coltrane and the voice of Alice Coltrane. This is From the Vault, the Pacifica Radio Archives weekly program that brings our history out of the vault and onto the radio. And I'm Brian DeShazer, director of the Pacifica Radio Archive. On January 12, 2007, Alice Coltrane passed away from respiratory failure in the West Hills of Los Angeles. She was 69. Born in Detroit on August 27, 1937, Alice McLeod was raised around music. Her mother was a singer and piano player, while her brother played bass professionally. Alice studied in Paris with the legendary jazz pianist Bud Powell, and she played in jazz ensembles with vibist Terry Gibbs, saxophone players Yusuf Lateef and Lucky Thompson, and guitarist Kenny Burrell. After her husband's death, she wrote and produced her own albums, incorporating the harp into compositions, and is now largely credited with the inclusion of that instrument into modern jazz. Outside of music, Alice Coltrane was a writer and spiritual leader, known in her religious community by her Sanskrit name, Turiyasangitananda. She founded the Vedantic Center, a spiritual commune in the Santa Monica Mountains on 48 acres. Despite all her accomplishments, Alice was a very humble woman, rarely speaking to the press and preferring to speak about John when she did. In July 2005, she was gracious enough to sit down with her friend and KPFK music programmer Maggie LaPique and Mark Torres, senior producer for the Pacifica Radio Archives. The interview is intimate and personal, sticking mostly to John's life and her life with him, but it is candid and unlike any other interview Alice Coltrane gave. We're proud to say it only exists here in the Pacifica Radio Archive. And this week, to honor Alice Coltrane and her husband John Coltrane, we air the documentary that was made from the original interview entitled Train Legacy.
Welcome to a very special KPFK and Pacifica Radio Archives program. I'm Maggie LaPique, and joining me is Mark Torres.
In this program, we will be honoring the life, music, spirituality, and love that is the legacy of John Coltrane, one of the most innovative and influential musicians of the 20th century. We will present John's music, his words.
You don't go to school and say, sit down and say, I know what you're getting ready to teach me, you know? You sit there and you learn, you open your mind, your thoughts. You got to be quiet, you got to be still to do this.
And an interview with his wife, Alice Coltrane.
He was very inventive, too creative, always thinking about music, always composing music. Reaching home after a concert, he's in the house at 3 o'clock in the morning practicing.
Yeah. John Coltrane was born September 23, 1926, on the day of the autumn equinox, one of the 2 days during the year in which night and day are in perfect balance. From the age of 12, with clarinet in hand, Train got serious about his music. Only a year later, losing two very important people in his life, his grandfather and then his father, his music took on a deeper meaning. The death of the two strong men in his family affected him deeply, but more than anything else, this was the beginning of Train's ongoing dedication to musical study. On Thursday, July 14, 2005, Mark and I spoke with Alice Coltrane at her home in Los Angeles, California. She begins by describing how she came to know John.
My first experience with him was through the music itself, the recordings. Not having seen him perform or anything, it was the music that attracted a lot of us young people in Detroit years ago. And the time did come when he had a concert in Detroit, and myself and many of our musician friends, we wanted to make sure we were there to hear him perform. And I have to admit, it was outstanding, it was magnificent, it was superb in every way. After he performed, he did not go to a secluded dressing room or anything like that. He was standing right near the stage itself, about maybe 2 or 3 feet from going up, And I was standing there, and interestingly, I was thinking about this, so maybe I should just mention it. I was standing there, and very close to John, I have to admit. Maybe if he was 3 feet away, I probably was maybe another 3 or 4 feet away from him. Somebody walked past me and said, are you playing tonight? We wanted to know because we wanted to, you know, we wanted to hear you. I said, no, how could I? Not possible. we're all here to hear John. So what was interesting is when, as soon as he mentioned, are you playing tonight? We wanted to hear your concert. However, he jolted straight up. He was sort of like leaning for by whatever, a large table, but he was just had his elbow on it, sort of holding his forehead, pensive. The way I saw him so much, his spirit is so quiet, and he's the kind of person that you don't want to invade that, whatever that world of his own silence and his own contemplation. You don't want to enter that. Well, anyway, as soon as the person said, are you working tonight? We want to hear you play. And he jolted straight up and just looked at me. And I had not been introduced to him, so there was nothing I could say or do about that. But I noticed that was, it's just made a mark, you know, in my memory. And I think about it quite a bit. So that was sort of my first encounter with him. And then the next one of any importance had to be at Birdland when I was performing with Terry Gibbs' group. He was the headliner. John was the headliner. And we had this, I don't know, cubicle practically, sort of sitting room. And he would show up and he would be sitting on one end of the room. I sit on the other, and I never said anything to him because the silence was so heavy. The quietness was so thick that there was no way I was going to say anything to him. But after about 2-3 days, because I think we had 4 or 5 days, slowly some words would, like he'd speak, and like if I was reading something or if he was reading something, maybe we'd talk about the reading material. And from that, conversation developed and more, and we became friends.
How was John as a band leader?
Yes. He was very kind to everyone. He never insisted on anything. He is very mild-mannered. His character is of the highest order. I never seen him have an argument with anyone. I heard him explain things when there needed to be clarity about a certain subject, but there was never anger or sort of abrasive, reactionary tone in his voice. It was just always very kind, very even, tempered, very balanced, his manner. And I think that he was respected by the musicians for that. I respected him also for that, because I've seen leaders sort of under the pressure of the leadership and the responsibility and all that. I've seen them just not be able to be in good control. And he was always, whether we traveled or for something about the ticketing or about the concert, the contract, he was just very mild and very even-minded, even-tempered.
Did you ever have an experience where you were playing with John, where you were able to pause for a moment and almost not believe what you were hearing, creating?
I think not, which I think is interesting, because some people think, how could you even play anything? It seems like you would have only been in awe of sitting in that position next to him, playing this music. Here he is, a creator and an innovator of a sound that was just so beyond our thinking. And to sit in that seat. Also, McCoy Tyner, I felt, is a great musician and a great innovator. Believe me, I never had any qualms about it. And I feel the reason is the assurance came from him, from John. Had he said, you know, I really want you in the band, because he asked me. I was surprised the day that he asked me, because the other band had gone on their way, separate ways. It surprised me. I didn't know why I would not even take the time out to find someone to take the position that McCoy had. And when he said, I want you, you know, to join the band, be with us, play with us. So I said, okay. It's fine by me if this is what you want. So I didn't have a fear, a doubt. I knew I had a lot to learn, but I felt what a great opportunity to learn. You know, I wouldn't want that forfeited for anything. So I gladly accepted, and it was beautiful. It was a great experience. I think it lasted about a year because of his health and everything, but it was wonderful, wonderful. Just for us to, you know, play music together. In the house is what we did most of the time. Once the little ones were asleep, this is what we did in the evening. We'd go over music, try new music, read some of the scores and whatnot, like Stravinsky, Schoenberg. We'd look at their offerings, and it was a nice time to be with someone who was at such a level of high respect and high achievement. You know, it's okay. I feel great to walk along beside someone and you both can relate to each other because you're sort of at that level. But it was greater respect for someone who was so achieved in their field. And that you don't expect. You don't expect that this is someone that's looked upon with such great honor, and deservedly so. I mean, we'd never heard a music that, we'd never heard even a sound like that. And you know, we had great people before us, Lester Young, Charlie Parker, all of those great players, and they had their unique sound, which was their gift. When John came out, that we heard him. We heard his sound. We heard something that hadn't been exploited, that hadn't been played. Not like that.
You spent a lot of time with John during the turbulent times, of course, the 60s. Mm-hmm. It was the decade of the civil rights. How were you and John affected by these turbulent times that saw the rise of black consciousness in many forms?
Mm-hmm. We were affected to the point that we wanted to do whatever we could. We wrote letters to Congressman Conyers. He wrote a letter to Dick Gregory. And the purpose in those letters was to mention if black people could become empowered more financially, it would really end a lot of the strife and a lot of the confusion would end, since it's a basically monetary state that we live in this country. America is, that's the whole heart and spirit of America. And he wrote letters that he couldn't get a decent answer from. Dick Gregory was real strong in the 60s, always with a mic, always busy. And when his program was presented, he did reply, Listen how simplistic it was. Let us encourage people of color, just save $1. $1 or contribute $1 a month so that you can build your own schools, you can have your own banks, you can own your own businesses. In those days, you couldn't get a $3,000 small businessman's loan. You couldn't. Even into the 80s, you couldn't get a $5,000 small businessman's loan. It was very sad. You know, he was looking for solutions. Nothing came up, but I know that one person alone can make a difference. But you need strength in numbers. And you need to reach many thousands of people. And people with a mic had the outlet. They had the means by which to reach the masses. And it didn't happen. So it was a lot, you know, it's just sadness to see the assassinations that occurred, the Kennedy brothers, Reverend Martin Luther King, and so forth, people dying for what they believe in, and that was a very sad time.
The song playing over the break was Alabama, recorded in November of 1963, just 2 months after the church bombing in Alabama, which took the lives of 4 black children.
You've told this story to me before, but I just love to hear it. The story of John working on the great composition, A Love Supreme.
Yeah. Well, what happened? He sort of isolated himself in the house from everybody. There was an upstairs bedroom. He would go up there and sit down, meditate, think about music, etc., etc. Then there came this time when he went upstairs and didn't come downstairs. So I had to find out, you know, what's going on. And he just said, there's a lot on my mind, and I want to just spend the time alone in the silence here. So I said, okay. And I just made sure his meals brought to him on time. And that was it. He was up there for nearly a week. We didn't see him. The children didn't see him. And when he came down, that was such a beautiful moment for me. When he came down the stairs, he just reminded me of how Moses could have looked coming down from the mountain. He looked different. He had sort of like an illumination on his face. It was so beautiful. When he reached down, I just said, well, how was it? You know, everything. He said, this is the first time that I will do a recording where I have everything complete before time. He said, everything is in form. Everything has been done. There's nothing left to do but record it. This will be the first time this ever happened. People know of many times John would be in the hallway composing music for his record date. So they know about those times. So he was there to tell me the first time, I have everything accomplished. ¶¶
about to hear excerpts from a rare interview with John Coltrane from the Pacifica Radio Archives, done in November 1966, less than a year before his death. The interview was done by Frank Kofsky after he ran into Coltrane in Los Angeles. In the interview, John discusses his art, the meaning of music in man's existence, and his spiritual approach to life. In this segment, he reveals a little-known secret about his saxophone.
Well, after Chasing the Train came out and then Impressions came out, you did a sort of change of pace. You remember you did the album with Duke and the ballads and the Johnny Harmon album. Whose idea were those albums? Were they yours or were they impulses?
Well, I tell you, I had some trouble at that time. I did a foolish thing. I got dissatisfied with my mouthpiece. And I had some work done on this thing. And instead of making it better, it ruined it. And it really it discouraged me, you know, a little bit, because I couldn't. There were certain aspects of that, of playing that certain fast thing that I was reaching for, that I couldn't get, you know, pushed because I damaged this thing. So I just had to curtail it.
Until you got another.
Well, actually, I never found another, but after so much of just laying around and making these kind of things, I said, well, what the hell, you know? I might as well go ahead and do the best I can. But at that moment, it was so vivid in my mind, the difference in the what I was getting on the horn. It was so vivid in my mind, and so I couldn't do it, because as soon as I'd do it, I'd hear it, and it just discouraged me, see. But after a year or so passed, well, I'd forgotten.
That's funny, because, you know, I think I know your music as thoroughly as any non-musician, and yet that wouldn't have been apparent to me.
Well, that's a funny thing, man. That's one of the mysteries. And to me, as soon as I put that horn in my mouth, I could hear. I could feel it, you know. So I just stopped. I just went into other things.
The reason I asked that was because you recall that was the time you had Eric in and out of the band.
Yeah.
And there was a whole wave of really hostile criticism.
Yeah, all of this was at the same time. So you can see how it was. I needed all the strength I could have at that time.
And
maybe some of these things might have caused me to feel that, well, you know, I can't get what I want out of this mouthpiece, so I'll work on it.
Do you think then this might have undermined your self-confidence to a degree?
It could have. It certainly could have.
Why do you think there's been all this hostility to the new music? Especially in your case.
Oh, man, I never could figure it out, you know. And I couldn't even venture to answer it now. Because as I told them then, I just felt that they didn't understand.
Do you feel that they were making...
So I feel that they didn't understand.
Do you think that they were making as conscientious and as thorough an attempt to understand as they could have?
At times I didn't feel they were, because I did... offer to them, I think in this article in Downbeat, I asked if any of you men were interested in, trying to understand, let's get together and let's talk about it, you know. I felt that they were really genuinely interested or thought there was something here that they, instead of just condemning it, what you don't know about it, we want to discuss it, let's talk about it. But no one ever, you know, came forth, so I don't think they were really... They didn't want to know what I had to say about it.
I think it frightened them. Bill.
Well, it might have.
Bill said, you know, we talked about this at great length, and he said, well, these guys, see, it's taken them years to learn how to pick out I Got Rhythm on the piano, and now the new music comes along and undermines their entire career, which is built around understanding
It could be. I dug it like that too. I said, well, it could be a real drag to a cat's career if he figures this is something that he won't be able to cope with and he won't be able to write about, you see. And if he can't write about it, he can't make a living at this. And then I realized that, so I quieted down. I wouldn't allow myself to become too hostile back, you know, in return. Although there was a time I kind of froze up on the people at Downbeat. I froze because, I don't know, I felt that that was something that it wasn't. I felt that they were letting their weakness direct their actions, which I didn't feel it should have.
Of course, that makes me want to kill all those people because...
Well, man, you know.
Because I get so much pleasure out of your music.
Yeah, well, the test was for me. That's what it was for. You know, they could do what they want to do. But the thing was for me to remain firm in what I was doing. But that was a funny time, particular period in my life, because I went through quite a few changes, you know, like the home life, everything, man. I just went through something. Everything I was doing did this.
The perfect wrong time to hit you.
everything I was doing did like that.
Yeah.
But it was a hell of a test for me, and coming out of it, it's just like I always said, man, when you go through these crises in life, you come through them, I come out of them, you're definitely stronger.
Yeah, if you
in a great sense, yeah.
Did the reaction of Impulse to these adverse criticisms have anything to do with those records that we talked about?
The ballads and the... Well, I don't know. I think Impulse was interested in having what they might call a balanced sort of thing, or a diverse sort of catalog, you know, and I'd find nothing wrong with this myself. You see, I like. In fact, most of the songs I even write now have been written. The ones which I really consider songs are ballads. So there's something there that I mean I really love these things.
Oh, they're beautiful.
And these ballads that came out were definitely ones which I felt at this time. And I chose them, and it seemed to be something that was laying around in my mind from my, you know, youth or somewhere that I just had to do.
Did John ever express to you that the critics' lack of understanding of what he was trying to do in his later years was disheartening or affected him in some negative way?
No, because I used to talk about it to him. I was concerned about it because he got a lot of critiques that we both knew. They're basically out of ignorance. You don't know the man's mind. You don't know how his brain operates. You don't know what he's doing in his music. You cannot sit at the table and discuss what he's doing. You can't do it. He can have the music in front of you. So what are you going to pick out? You know, triad here, you know, or an augmented chord there? Sorry. So he used to smile about it. That was it. Never angry, never upset, like some of the New York musicians. They call those critics up and tell them, you better change what you said about me, or else.
You're listening to Alice and John Coltrane in a special documentary made in Los Angeles at the Pacifica Radio Archives in 2005, entitled Train Legacy.
Do you make any attempt, or do you feel you should make any attempt, to educate your audience in ways that aren't musical? But it's obvious you want your audience to understand what you're doing musically, but do you feel that... you want them to understand other things, too, and that you have some kind of responsibility.
Sure, I try to feel this, and this is one of the things I'm concerned about now. I just don't know how to go about this. I want to find out just how I should do it, you know, and I think it's going to have to be very subtle. I mean, you can't ram philosophies down anybody's throat, and the music is enough, you know, and that's philosophy. But I think the best thing I can do this time is just try to get myself in shape, you know, and know myself. If I can do that, then I'll just play, you see. And leave it at that. Then I believe that will do it. You know, if I really can get to myself and really and then be just as I feel and I should be and play it, you see, and I think they'll get it because music goes a long way and it really is. It can influence.
That's how I got interested in all those things I was talking about earlier. I mean, in Malcolm X and so forth. I might not have come to it or come to it as fast if it hadn't been for the music, because that was my first introduction to something beyond my own horizons, and it made me think about the world I was living in.
That's what I'm sure, man. I'm sure. I'm really sure of this thing. And as I say, there are things which, as far as spirituality is concerned, which are very important to me at this time. And I've got to grow through certain, you know, phases of this to other understandings and more, you know, consciousness and awareness of just what it is that I'm supposed to, you know, understand about it. And I'm sure all this will be part of the music, which is, to me, you know, I feel I want to be a force for good.
And the music, too.
Everywhere. You know, I want to be a force for real good. In other words, I know that there are bad forces. You know, I know that there are forces out here which bring suffering to others and misery to the world. But I want to be the opposite, of course. I want to be a force which is truly for good.
Why don't we just look over the discography over the years? Everything, it seemed, had a religious tone or a spiritual sentiment within it. The song titles, Dear Lord, Om, Love Supreme. That's a good point if you really want to take a good analysis. Start from Love Supreme up until the end. Everything has a spiritual theme, and more of a opportunity to allow your consciousness to become more universal, to be more appreciative of what gifts have been given in life, in the spirit, in the world. And I think he did, because many people would tell things, you know, like, this is how I got through school. This is how I was able to get through my day on my job. I had a person write me and tell me, many of my family has a guru, but my guru is John Coltrane. Because it's the effect of allowing me to advance spiritually, mentally. It allows me to edify my life. I feel an upliftment when I hear his music. I said, well, that's really great. I said, what about some of the more vigorous pieces? He said, doesn't matter. One person said, I let my children go to sleep at night listening to his music.
Describe finally the strength of John Coltrane, the man, the musician. John says, regardless of what the critics say, he remained strong and resolved in his pursuit of his new musical direction.
Indomitable, undying, vigilant, steadfast. I think earlier it was stated that I believe he was already there for the transition in terms of his music from where it was to what it became. And that was sort of working through, like, it was like a thread going through everything he did. And it was so powerful. And I think you all saw physical changes when he had the two drummers, he had the two basses. So powerful. So incredible. And then eventually he got Burl Sanders. And people say, well, why does he want that person up there? He can do a... See, they didn't know how to realize what he was trying to do. So what he could hear. He could hear the two horns. He could hear two drums. He could hear the two basses. He could hear the pianist. They couldn't hear it. You know, it's like he said, if you listen to a chamber orchestra, there are many different... instruments, some of them playing a lot of the same notes or whatever, but no one is complaining because there's 25 people here, or there's 60 or 80, however, in some of your large symphonic orchestras. So this is what the people complained about, sort of like they want John Coltrane to remain sort of in their image, and it was going to never happen. I feel it was his life. And to me, music is so wonderful. It's so powerful. Music is utilized for healing. Music makes people forget their pain, their troubles. Music is used in practically every religious service all over the world. Music is utilized in worship of God. So he was already sort of like within that inner circle of knowing that here is an invisible force. Not really. He checked it out. He found out it had life, you know, that it was as well material, because he used to watch it on an oscilloscope. But it's a powerful, nearly invisible force that reaches into the hearts of people. Not only the intellect and the intelligence, but to reach into the heart and the spirit. And that's where good is taking place at such time.
Do you still miss him?
Yes. I think about him. I miss him a lot. My children grew up without him, basically. He's seen none of his grandchildren, at least not through the human eye. But I believe that God knew when was the best time to take him from the earth. Why? And it, for me, I felt I was prepared for it. We used to meditate together in the vision. He would speak to me, tell me things, he'd show me things. And one day he did say, I'll be going on to enlightenment. I'll repeat that again. He said, I'll be going on to enlightenment. So I didn't really fully grasp, but as the days proceeded, I understood fully that he would be going on to a light beyond this world.
Alice Coltrane speaking about her husband John in July of 2005. Alice, too, went on to a light beyond this world on January 12, 2007.
If John were alive today, what do you think he'd be doing?
Practicing.
The music you heard during this hour was Acknowledgement from the live version of A Love Supreme recorded at the Antibes Jazz Festival in July 1965 and taken from the CD A Love Supreme, the deluxe edition.
Blue Train, recorded at the Van Gelder Studio, Hackensack, New Jersey, in September 1957 and taken from the CD Blue Train.
Pristine, recorded in New York City, December 1957, for an Art Blakey Big Band album, taken from the CD John Coltrane Best of the Bethlehem Sessions.
Giant Steps, recorded at the Atlantic Studios in New York in May 1959, and taken from the album Giant Steps.
My Favorite Things, recorded at Atlantic Studios in October 1960 and taken from the CD My Favorite Things.
Equinox, recorded on the same day as some of the tracks for My Favorite Things and taken from the Rhino Records CD The Very Best of John Coltrane.
Alabama, recorded in November 1963 at Rudy Van Gelder's studio in Englewood Cliffs, New Jersey, and taken from the CD Live at Birdland.
Ogunde, recorded April 23, 1967 at the Olatunji Center of African Culture in New York City, and taken from the CD The Olatunji Concert, The Last Live Recording.
The musicians featured on the recordings you heard include McCoy Tyner, Elvin Jones, Jimmy Garrison, Alice Coltrane, Pharoah Sanders, Lee Morgan, Curtis Fuller, Paul Chambers, Philly Joe Jones, Cedar Walton, Lex Humphreys, Donald Byrd, Steve Davis, Walter Bishop Jr., and Art Blakey. This program was produced and written by Mark Torres and Maggie LaPique. The Alice Coltrane interview was engineered by Oranian Coltrane.
Special thanks to the Coltrane family, Marilyn McLeod, Jerry O., and KPFK program director Armando Guadino.
The Frankowski interview of John Coltrane from November 1966 is courtesy of the Pacifica Radio Archives. Peace and love. Train lives.
That's it for Africa World Now Project for this week. I would like to thank you for joining us today and look forward to spending time with you next week. We can be reached through all your regular social media platforms. Email africaworldnowproject@gmail.com or follow us on Twitter at AFWRLDNWPRJ. I'm your host and producer, James Pope. The Africa World Now Project Collective consists of international media journalist, executive producer, and human rights activist Moise Mutale, Africa World Now Project media correspondent Funda Ngunda, senior research, content contributor, and production director Dr. Tasneem Siddiqui, senior researcher and content contributor and production associate Dr. Josh Myers, associate producer and content contributor Dr. Keisha Khan Perry, technology advisor is Byron Gray of GrayWorks Technology, and creative director is Judah Pope. Africa World Now Project is heard every Wednesday at 7 p.m. on WSNC, NPR affiliate and broadcasting service of Winston-Salem State University. Shows are archived weekly on SoundCloud. Search Africa World Now Project. Until next week, be safe, be peaceful, and above all, be intelligent.